On January 23rd, U.S. Senator and Democratic presidential hopeful Bernie Sanders shared an article about Missouri on his Facebook page. The article was originally published in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and the headline reads, "Union membership in Missouri rises, bucking national trend." Missourians who follow Sanders got very excited and passed the article around on their accounts, meaning this news about Missouri's supposed union friendliness got a national audience. I read the article, though, and what it actually says about Missouri is a little murkier and harder to parse out than the headline alone might imply, because yes, union membership rose in Missouri in 2018, even as it dropped nationwide. But that was only after it had been on the decline in the state in the years before, and the decline was steeper than the national average. So what does all of this put together actually mean? I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and that's the conversation on today's show. If you come from a union family in Missouri, we would love to hear your insights. What's the change you've witnessed? 816-235-2888 is the number to call. Let's start with the author of that article, It was in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, as we mentioned, and David Nicholas. Good morning.
Good morning, Gina.
What's your summary of what the numbers actually reveal?
Well, what the numbers show is that union membership was up last year in Missouri by about 25,000 members, which is pretty good. It was nationally, union membership has been declining. And in fact, most years for the last 15 or 20 years, it's been declining in Missouri too. So this was, as the headline said, it is bucking the trend a bit. However, it's not all good news. The union membership rate in Missouri 15 years ago was about at the national average, and now we've fallen faster than the rest of the country. So we're now about a percentage point below the nation. And we can get into why that is, but a lot has to do with sort of changing industrial mix in the state.
Yeah, can you flesh that out a little bit?
Oh, sure. I mean, in St. Louis, we before the recession in 2007 and 2008, we lost a Ford plant and a Chrysler plant, two Chrysler plants actually. Those were well-paying union jobs. The construction industry, which is sort of a bastion of union labor, is smaller than it was 10 years ago, and we're just much less of an industrial economy than we were back in the 1990s.
Can you tell me a little bit more about the data you were looking at when you began to think about writing this article and what it was that interested you?
Oh, I try the Bureau of Labor Statistics comes out with this every year, and I try to take a look at it, every year when the report comes out. And I knew this year, 2018, would be interesting because unions were so much in the news in Missouri. We had the big vote in August on the right to work issue, which the union side won, and that obviously energized union members and union leaders, and maybe that had something to do with the uptick in organizing.
So, are there, you've mentioned the change in the industrial mix, as you put it, in Missouri. Mm-hmm. Are there particularities other than that to consider when we talk about labor in Missouri more broadly?
Well, one fact to know about unions is the rate of membership is much higher among government workers than in the private sector. It's now, we don't have that breakdown by state, but nationally, it's 34% of all government employees belong to a union. In the private sector, it's only 6%, so about one fifth the rate. I would say it's probably consistent with that in Missouri. I mean, teachers and many other police officers, many other public sector workers are belong to unions in Missouri. That's pretty much the case in every state.
Well, I'm going to come back to you and your article, but I want to bring Judy Ansel in on this. She's a well-known scholar of labor here in town with her own show on KKFI. She used to run the labor studies program at UMKC, and she does a lot of work around labor and social justice locally and also in South America. Judy Ansel, hello.
Hi. Pleasure to be here.
What do you want to add about the particularities regarding labor in Missouri, either present tense or from a historical sort of like background perspective?
Well, there's really a lot, Gina. But just in response to what we've heard so far, I just want to say that I did look at the statistics for different sectors in the labor movement in Missouri to try to figure out where these 25,000 new members came from. And lo and behold, they're in the public sector almost exclusively. In fact,
can you explain what that means? Like, what kind of jobs are we talking about?
Okay, we're talking about people who work for federal, state, and local governments. Everything from teachers and firefighters and policemen all the way up to the people who work at our Social Security office downtown in Kansas City.
What does that say to you?
It says to me, Trump. For the federal workers, it's clearly they feel under attack, and they're joining many of them who weren't members of the union because public sector workers at all levels in Missouri are under what we call in the private sector right to work. They do not have to join the union or pay dues. They can get all the representation they want for free. And so what's happened is that because of the threats that have come, for instance, you know, Trump froze federal pay. And, you know, we could talk about the shutdown and all of that stuff, but he's been attacking federal workers and the federal workforce now since he came into office. And so I would presume, and I haven't done the interviews to back it up, but I would presume that union leaders will tell you that they are getting more members signing up just out of a sense of self-protection at the federal level. And then we have at the local and state level, Missouri labor law for the public sector has always been pretty awful. We are not one of those states that has full-blown collective bargaining. However, we have the right to organize and to bargain in our Constitution, which is very unusual for a state.
There are a couple of details that I'd like you to explain a little bit more. The first one being collective right to bargain.
Right. Okay, so collective bargaining is the fundamental thing that gives workers power. If you're trying to negotiate your salary or your working conditions on your own, you have very little power vis-a-vis your employer because, you know, they can just say, go find another job. You're an at-will employee. You don't have any rights. The only way you get rights as a worker in this country in general is by organizing with other workers, by engaging in what the law calls concerted activity.
That's like if you get rid of me, there's no one else who's going to step in and take my place because this is
because
a matter of principle and it affects all of us, that kind of thing?
Well, it's the power comes from us. The power comes from all of the workers, you know, coming to the employer at the same time saying we want a raise or we want to get paid for overtime or, you know, whatever, you know, affects workers these days. There's lots of issues in the workplace.
And so Missouri's relationship with collective bargaining rights sounds unusual in
well,
some ways.
It's certainly less progressive than most other states in the Midwest as well as East and West Coast. It's the law they have has not kept up with the Constitution, as a matter of fact. But I don't want to get too wonky about this.
Yeah.
The fact is that not only do public sector workers have fewer unions than, for instance, in Illinois, right next to us, because the law has made it not that worth it. Okay. But also,
so do you
last
think that
year,
kind the, of explains the decline that it
no,
maybe? Oh, okay, good.
No.
Go on.
They never got organized.
Okay,
it's always been lower.
Okay,
because the law has been so backward. But what happened last year is that the legislature passed a bill called House Bill 1413, which is absolutely draconian, according as far as the rights of public employees are concerned. So they are really under attack. And I would presume that, and then folks like the Firefighters Union was completely excluded from any coverage of public sector labor law in the state. So what the legislature has done to public sector workers has clearly put them on the defensive. My guess is a number of them signed up for the union in order to protect themselves.
David Nicholas, chime back in here.
No, I think that's a very very cogent analysis. I mean, there have been some small organizing victories. I remember last summer the grad student assistants at the University of Missouri won a court victory saying they could organize. That's another public sector union, I guess, since it's a state university. There in St. Louis, one of our big companies, Express Scripts, hires a contractor for its custodial work, and those janitors organized last year with the service employees union. It's about 50 people. These are relatively small employee groups. So there have been some organizing victories, but I think what our other guest said that it's a lot of the changes in the public sector and just federal and state and maybe local workers just looking for some additional protection and perhaps realizing the value of unions. Maybe all of the publicity around the bills that were mentioned and around the right to work vote made those workers aware of the value of their union.
We also just had a minimum wage increase in Missouri. Does that factor in here? Judy, why don't you handle this one?
Okay. The Missouri minimum wage fight was part of three big fights that working people made in the last year. One was, of course, the repeal of right to work. The other was the passage of the Clean Amendment to the state constitution. And I'm on the leadership team of Kansas City Jobs with Justice, which is the minimum wage fight was our fight. And we won that by 62% of the vote. We did that a lot with the help of organized labor. But all three of those battles activated working people, both union members and not. And so I think that the more we organize ourselves, whether it's politically or in the workplace, the more that helps build union power.
You know, David, I'm interested in your response to Judy's analysis, this part of Judy's analysis involving that the laws in Missouri have made it such that being a member of a union has been not quite as worth it as it might be in another state. Is that your sense as well?
Oh, that's true for the public sector. I mean, not for the private sector. If the right to work legislation had stuck, in other words, if the voters hadn't overturned it in August, it would have weakened unions in the private sector as well. But we've always had that sort of right to work provision or for the public sector for a long time. There are about 32,000 Missourians who are in union represented jobs but have chosen not to join the union. I don't know the breakdown, but I suspect a large number, probably a majority of those, are in the public sector.
Let's talk to Jason. Jason is giving us a call with his own experience. Hi, Jason.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What do you want to share?
I'd like to share that, I think in the grand scheme of things, unions are great. They help keep our employers honest and as far as making sure that we have fair wages. At the same time, they can be kind of exploitive in the sense of collecting dues and not doing much. But in the grand scheme of things, They're great.
Can I back up and ask you something? Can I ask you about your personal relationship with unions so that we just know where you're coming from and what your experience has been?
One good experience is that I was off of work for several months.
Wait, so are you a union member? I'm sorry, I'm just trying to establish.
Yes, I apologize. I am a union member, and I was off of work due to an injury for several months, and then all of a sudden I have a large lump sum of pay in my bank account because not because of my injury, but because our contract had expired for over a year. When our new contract was agreed or ratified, all that back pay from the time the contract had expired to what it should be was paid to me, and that was awesome. And I would not have had that without representation of my union brothers and sisters.
And so some of your sense of like the downside does have to do with dues, in a sense that that the union itself can have power, kind of a dynamic that maybe would be equivalent to an employer's power in some situations, something like that.
Correct. I mean, it's political, like in every industry. As far as, you know, everybody's trying to climb the ladder to for their own self-interest and succeed. And so on a one-on-one relationship, sometimes your union rep or union president will go to a battle for you in an issue and file a grievance. And other times they'll lay down and concede. And that's kind of a tough thing, tough pill to swallow at times. But
Jason, before I let you go, I am curious what industry you work in.
I am a letter carrier.
Letter carrier. Hmm. So
yes.
This public sector issue also applies to you?
Correct.
Any insights in the comments we've heard about that aspect of this so far, that a lot of the union membership increase we've seen in Missouri is within the public sector?
You know, I can't totally. I can only speak for my industry. I know that it's increased because they've done more hiring. But then, I don't know about the other sectors, such as construction and whatnot.
Well, thanks, Jason.
Truck driving.
Thanks for your call.
Bye bye.
Judy Ansel, respond to, there are a couple things he said that I'd like you to respond to. One being this sense that he made a great case for the upsides of union mm-hmm. membership, very powerful case. But he also mentioned this issue of hierarchy and bureaucracy within the unions themselves.
You know, I think that what everybody has to understand is actually unions are some of the most democratic institutions in our society. They are, by law and by their own constitutions, democratic organizations. We elect leaders, and they have, they have to run for re-election every 3 years in most unions, and they are accountable to their members. But if the members don't participate, or if only a handful of members participate, there's not much that a member like Jason can do to change bad leaders. And of course, there are some bad leaders. As a general rule, I'd say that union leaders are some of the most dedicated people I've ever met in my life. They're good members of society. They care about the other person. That's why they're active in their union. But there are bad apples, but the main problem I see is that the membership doesn't care that much, doesn't participate. And if you don't participate, you can't preserve democracy.
You know, David, for you, I mean, you've written this article about the union membership numbers in Missouri. Is there anything that you would want to point out about the big picture when it comes to organized labor in Missouri that the numbers in the article don't capture?
One thing I would say, just speaking as a reporter, is and following up what Judy said. Yeah, unions are very democratic. Most of them well run. With a few exceptions. One thing I found as a reporter is they're not terribly good at telling their story. when there's an, you know, an issue between a union and a company, the corporate side has image consultants and public relations people, and the union usually just has its leaders, and some of them are not very responsive to, you know, to our inquiries, or they're just not very very good at telling the story. I think that's that is something that the whole union movement could work on.
Well, I'm Gina Kaufman. People will have the chance to tell their stories in just a minute. 816-235-2888. We're talking about unions in Missouri, where the numbers on union membership paint a confusing picture. 816-235-2888 is the number to call. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about unions in Missouri with Judy Ansel. She's the former director of UMKC's Labor Studies program, and David Nicholas, a business columnist for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, whose pretty brief article on union membership in Missouri got an unexpected national audience when Bernie Sanders shared it on Facebook. Hello again to both of you.
Hi.
Hi.
So let's talk to Corey calling us from Raytown. Hi, Corey.
Hi, Gina. Thanks for having me on. I'm not a union member, but I'm from a union family. My dad worked road construction here in Kansas City for about 40 years and was part of the local Teamsters chapter for over 30. And it was the kind of job that, you can't take your kid out on, take your child to work day. My dad, he kind of rarely ever talked about his job. And as a kid, I was never really sure about it until I got older. And the reason he rarely spoke about it was because it was dangerous, because he wasn't entirely sure if he'd come home at the end of the day, and he didn't want his son worrying about that. And that's because he had been on jobs where he had seen a coworker struck by a driver and killed. And my dad wasn't all rah-rah about unions. He complained about them at times. He was pretty active. He would attend meetings every month. They can be bureaucratic, just like government sometimes, there can be issues there. There are times where he felt, unions established price was cheating his company out of work with rival contractors. But that aside, he participated in one because he saw the importance of what they did. And, you can't have workers be at the mercy of companies. I mean, not saying that companies are evil, but they can be willing to fudge safety restrictions to meet a bottom line. And if that means meeting deadlines on contracts, even if there aren't enough workers, maybe they don't put out as much signage as they should, to warn drivers. Maybe they don't replace equipment as regularly as they should. And I don't know. Like, I mean, I'm not a union member, but I mean, as a son of a union member, I do appreciate it, that there was someone out there looking out for my dad.
So
and
that he could come home.
That's what unions kind of mean to me.
Yeah, I want some response to this. Thank you so much, Corey. There can be so much emphasis on the bargaining around salary or income and wages that it's easy to overlook all of the other issues that unions are out there representing workers on. Judy, can you talk about that?
Sure. And I think that the caller raised a really important point about health and safety. I think that unions protect lives, because you have somebody to go to besides your boss if there is a health and safety concern. And when you don't have that, you often not only are not working in a safe workplace, but if you do get hurt on the job, you have nobody to stand up for you.
You have this question of, do I stand up for my safety or my paycheck?
Exactly. You're taking risks every time you fight back because you're on your own. I have a friend who just got hurt on a non-union job, and they're denying her workers' compensation. And the only person she can go to is a lawyer. So, that's the recourse you have, and that takes months and months because there's nobody on her job because she has no union to stand up for her. So making workplaces safer is one of the key elements, forever, historically, ever since unions began as far as helping workers.
Let's talk to Charlie in Brookside. Hi, Charlie.
Hello.
What do you want to share?
Well, I called because you're asking for people with family union background, and I do come from a multi-generational union background and present, actually. I was in the sheet metal union in the 70s for 10 years, and then I started my own business in construction, so I've really got almost 40 years of experience being a business owner. So I've seen both sides. I do agree so much with, I thought it was a great point that one of your guests there had about the unions not really having a good storyteller, someone that stands up to them, that has the money and the approach that the non-union members, let alone the politicians that are backing, you know, and the lobbyists and such side, because there's so much history that the union has that has brought us the things that the last few callers have talked about, the decent wages, the safety, the health, the insurance and such, that whether you're union or not has benefited you and OSHA. There is a lot there, and people, it'd be interesting to have a story about what if there never had been unions, where would it be now?
You know, Charlie, can I just jump in to ask, you know, this question about the multi-generational experience, and I'm curious about your particular industry, the sheet metal industry. Can you tell me a little bit about, have you seen change over, like, just comparing stories going back generations, like, what the union's, like, role in those negotiations was and has been and maybe is now? Just, have you seen change? Have you suspected that things have changed?
Well, I'll do my best, but as I said, when I almost 40 years ago left the union and sheet metal and started my business in construction, I have not been active in the union. That would give you a better answer. I can speak to what I knew at that time and what my business side tells me now.
Please do.
Back before and in the 70s, the union was a place that we would meet monthly, and we had the representatives, as was said, that for our local branch that would represent us, and I felt connected to them. I knew who they were. We voted for them, and I thought they were good people. I think before that and since then, certainly there are bad apples, and they get all the press, and so much, unfortunately, is lost about the good ones and the good unions and such, and that focus, which I think partially is a problem because of the lack of PR on the union people's side, is the focus is on that bad, quote-unquote, part of unions.
Mm-hmm.
And
so you've seen the bigger conversation change more than you've seen the unions themselves change.
I think it did. And that's when there was a big nosedive on union membership after I had left, actually, in the 80s and further as it came forward. And Kansas became a right-to-work law. So
thank you, Charlie.
It did change at that time.
Thank you so much for that call.
Sure.
So this right-to-work issue comes up again. Can you, Judy, give us a quick, like, side-by-side Kansas and Missouri comparison? Because that's kind of part of what Charlie is bringing up. And we are on a state line here.
Kansas passed its right-to-work law in the late 1950s, and then it added it to its constitution in the 70s. So it's been so-called right-to-work for a long time. Excuse me.
We can come back to this conversation.
I'm okay. Yeah. But, you know, I've noticed the farther west you go in Kansas, the more you see the effects of right to work. Unions in the metro area tend to have pretty high membership levels. What right to work does is it allows somebody to opt out of paying dues to the union. So, but the union, by federal law, is still required to represent them and would be guilty of a serious crime if it did not represent somebody who's a non-member. So what it does is it ends up undermining the financial security of the union because people feel like they can just get it, the services for free. So unions are weaker. As a result, they have less services, they have less staff, et cetera. And, but it, the closer you are to Kansas City, it seems the higher the membership because that culture of unionism is here. I think that's also true in Wichita. But you get into the smaller towns in Kansas and unions are very, very weak. And you see that reflected in the wages and working conditions.
Let's talk to Angela in Oak Grove. Hi, Angela.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for joining us.
I am a grandchild of two union members in the Kansas City Metro. My grandpa on my dad's side was an auto. He worked for Claycomo Ford for 40 years. And my mom's dad was a steelworker union. And my husband is a union member as well. And without the health benefits of the union and what they provide, my grandparents both would have been devastated because of health issues, and myself as well. I mean, I was in the hospital in 2014 and we didn't pay a dime. And without that, we would have been in a lot of trouble financially. So I say, yay union, I will always support the unions.
Well, can you, I guess I'm curious about the specifics of how the union membership specifically prevented your family from experiencing, it sounds like bankruptcy is what you're kind of implying there.
Yes, my dad's mom had lymphoma cancer for over 20 years and had to do maintenance chemo once she got through the actual chemotherapy for, you know, getting rid of a lot of it. And so she had to have chemotherapy once a year. And honestly, I don't ever recall her saying, oh, I need to make a payment for my medical bills. I don't think that she ever had to pay for any of the chemotherapy that, that she had.
Well, Angela, you know, we've been talking about that there maybe are not the same kind of storytellers coming out of unions and getting their message out.
I wish I could. From the bottom of my heart, I value the union. I just do.
Well, thank you for sharing your story is where I was going with that.
Oh, sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt.
No. Thank you. Thanks so much for calling.
Absolutely. Have a great day.
You too. I want to take another call from Sharon. Sharon is calling us from Lawrence. Hi, Sharon.
Hello.
What do you want to share?
Well, I am pushing 80 years old and grew up in a 1950s blue-collar working family. My father was active in the trades as an electrician in the electrical unions, used to be stenographer for his meetings at our house. And basically, my parents had a wonderful retirement, and he was a union person all of his life, and I credit the unions and the bargaining power for them having the retirement they had and the benefits that
perhaps,
they had.
Forgive me if you've already said this. What industry did your dad work in? What was his job?
He was in electrical maintenance. He was in the electrical union, worked for CFCA here in Lawrence and many other places, retired from Western Electric and Lee Summit, Missouri in the late 70s. He would be 103 years old right now.
Well, Sharon, thank you for that story. I want to follow up on it in a couple of ways. First of all, Judy Ansel, what is your sense of whether an electrical worker today would be able to, whether union membership would sort of pave the way for a comfortable retirement for an electrical worker today?
Absolutely. IBEW, which is the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, which represents most of those, that category of workers, has excellent pensions that they've negotiated and held on to, despite the fact that employers very often try to squeeze the pension money, pitting the younger workers who don't care so much about pensions against the older workers who do. And yet, you know, today, if you retire on an IBEW pension, well, it's an employee, it's a joint pension. It's what's called a Taft-Hartley fund. As a matter of fact, it's a joint pension fund between the contractors, if you're in the construction industry, or and the union, or it could be a company pension if you work for like KCP&L. All of those are very good retirement plans, much better than non-union workers would get unless they're public employees.
You know, Judy, earlier in the conversation, David Nicholas with the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, who we're going to hear again in a moment, but he told us about some of how the lay of the land has changed with the industrial mix in St. Louis. What would you say about Kansas City?
Kansas City has a very diverse economy. And St. Louis used to be much more heavily industrialized. It has lost a lot, particularly because of NAFTA and other globalized trade agreements. Kansas City didn't lose as much, but you know, we're very strong in the auto industry. We have two auto plants, and last year, for instance, part of that increase probably came from the Ford plant. It's now up to 7,000 workers, which is huge. I think it's the largest Ford plant in the United States in terms of employment is concerned. However, you know, we've lost a lot of what we used to have in steel. We lost Harley last year, which is another reason why, you know, manufacturing employment went down here in the Kansas City area. So, you know, there's ups and downs. We don't have any control over it, but it certainly affects the standard of living of people here and their opportunities.
So, David Nicholas, we started this conversation with your article in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, the article with the headline, Union Membership in Missouri Rises, Bucking National Trend. When Bernie Sanders shared this headline of yours, it got 4,900 reactions, 126 comments, and 652 shares. Would you say that's your typical traction for one of your columns on business in St. Louis?
No, that was a little bit, you know, a little bit out of the ordinary, and you know, I love reaching a wider audience. It's clearly a lot of people care about this issue, and that's great. I'm glad to provide them a little information and analysis.
What is your sense of what the level of interest is about beyond that it just got a wide platform by being shared by someone with the following that Bernie Sanders has? I mean, how would you say this issue fits into a national conversation in a way that a 2020 presidential hopeful might find compelling?
Well, I think we're clearly talking more and you know, hearing more about worker issues than we have for the last few years. I think, you know, some of President Trump's policies have brought this into focus, as well as state level issues like right to work and the minimum wage, which is also being debated at the federal level right now. The Democratic leadership is making a push to advance a minimum wage bill in the House, which hasn't happened in quite a few years. So those issues are, you know, going to be, you know, at least a part of the conversation. I don't know if they'll dominate the conversation as we work up to another election year in 2020, but they're clearly going to get a lot of attention.
Well, I'm Gina Kaufman. We'll have to end it there. Keep talking about labor in Missouri and in general. We're at KCURCST on Twitter if you want to keep the discussion going there. David Nicholas, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
And Judy Ansel, thank you.
It's a pleasure.
Up next, a song about gun violence performed by a choir. More on that coming up. Stay tuned. Anthony Maglione is a local composer and a professor at William Jewell College. He's written a choral song about gun violence. It's called No More, and it was commissioned for a project called Put the Guns Down, for a choir out of San Diego. On the eve of the one-year anniversary of the Parkland High School shooting, we thought we might play just a snippet of that song, No More, by Anthony Maglione.
Between 2011 and 2015,
2015
and 2015,
there were an average
of 11,564
gun-related homicides per year in the United States.
11,564 gun-related homicides per year in the United States. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. Anthony Maglione, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Gina. It's great to be here.
So for those of us who are not choral music experts, can you describe what we just heard musically?
Sure. What you just heard was a piece that was written for live performance choir, like one you'd see while going to a concert, but also what we call fixed media, which is pre-recorded sound that's been edited and manipulated by me to go along with that live performance.
And if we'd been watching the music video just now, what would we have seen?
During this part, you would have seen people getting ready to go about their daily lives and all meet up in a church for a service.
What is that image about to you? I was curious watching this, you know, we're hearing statistics. Is it almost like people hearing news of the day and still having to sort of find the will to pour their coffee, or?
You know, so the story behind the music video is that was directed by Peter Page, who is an actor and producer and director out in Hollywood, who's probably most known for his work on Queer as Folk back in the early 2000s. And I had very little to do with the direction of that video. But what I think they were going for was just this idea that you can be going about your day no matter where you're from, what your color is, what your faith tradition is. You can go to a place of worship, you can go to a school, and you're not safe.
So that brings me to the content, because obviously there's a lot to say about the music, but the content is something that everyone thinks about. And
sure.
This was a commission, so the topic of gun violence was established when you went into it. But talk to me about how you chose to approach it.
Yeah, it was commissioned for a group in San Diego for not the Put Your Guns Down project. That was for the group in L.A. But they're the ones who have recorded this piece, and it's on their album. But I decided to approach it by looking up statistics. The research started with statistics. So I went to the CDC and I went to the Brady campaign, and I looked up statistics on gun violence in the U.S. And I was immediately disheartened by the number of people who have passed in the last 10 years or so at that point in mass shootings. And that's where my focus went.
Where did the line "no more" come from? Because it's not just the name of the song. The choir is repeating no more, no
right.
more.
Well, in a discussion with a colleague of mine when I was trying to come up with how I would write this piece, I threw out, you know, how many more of these mass shootings do we need till the conversation is really started? The answer is really no more.
So you got most of your statistics. You've answered where they came from. How did you select which statistics? Because the number of different kinds of statistics you could share about
right.
gun violence, it's
that's right.
A lot.
Well, what I decided to do was go very broad. I started out at the beginning. It's a broad. This is the overall overview of gun violence in the U.S. And then in the second set of readings, which is towards the end of the piece, that is the specifics as to where the mass shootings occurred. And so I decided to go from sort of general to specific.
Was there one statistic that in particular you had felt fixated on in some way?
Yeah, 4 children a day. That gets me every time.
I mean, you know, and you wrote this, what, 2017, you're saying, is the commission?
Yeah, the commission was for, yeah, it was 2017. I was approached in 2016. So the data that I had at that time was basically up to date for 2015. And so I haven't gone into update, and I don't think I want to go into update the change in numbers.
You know, it strikes me that we are talking about this on the eve of the one-year anniversary of a shooting that happened after you wrote this song.
Yes.
What do you feel around that?
The hardest part about that whole thing was that I had to go back into the last set of readings. So the last set of readings at the end of the piece is essentially a list of all the places since 2005 that had mass shootings. And then I did it in a classical form, a canon. I had to go in and add names for this most recent recording, for Tonality, which is the group in LA who recorded this on their album, Sing About It.
That sounds painful to, yeah.
Yeah, it was hard. It was hard, but it was a request of the conductor and it made it into the music video. And it was important for those names to be there, particularly Parkland.
Do you think that there is something in saying the names of people who have died in a particular way that changes the conversation about what's happened to them?
You know, I don't know. All I know is that I was really inspired by a piece by John Adams called On the Transmigration of Souls that he wrote after 9/11. And it was a list of names of people who had passed. And I felt extremely moved by the way that was set. And I felt that this same kind of technique could be used to list out the names of locations, at least by their pop culture names, not necessarily the name of the high school or whatever.
You know, you bring up 9/11 and a musical piece that came out of that. And I wonder if choir activism is becoming a thing.
You know, I don't know if it's becoming a thing, but I know that it is a thing for certain groups, particularly this group Tonality out in Los Angeles, who I feel very connected to, not just because I have a colleague who's the conductor, but because I really stand behind a lot of what they're getting at with their concert programming and repertoire choices.
What do you think a big, beautiful choir lends to a social message, and particularly a disturbing social message?
You know, to any social message, it's amazing. Human voices are so personal, and an ensemble of human voices from different races, creeds, its backgrounds. It's remarkable to hear them come together unified in a thought or an idea.
What are the questions you wrestle with, either musically or politically or otherwise, when you consider doing a social justice choir piece?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, so for me, in particular for this piece, I'm not anti-gun. I have family who's law enforcement, and they're very fine law enforcement. And I'm not anti-Second Amendment, but I don't think that we should stand for this the epidemic of gun violence in our country, and I think something has to be done. I don't know what that answer is. I think there are people who are better equipped to make that to start those discussions. I just want to spur on the conversation.
So, you know, as it's come up a couple of times, we invited you here today in particular because tomorrow is the anniversary of that Parkland shooting, and unfortunately, there has been a local incident just last night with a student being shot at a school here in town. You don't want this topic to be timeless.
No, but I think that I don't know. And there are people who have very strong opinions as to why we're struggling with this right now in our culture. But it feels like it's not going away anytime soon.
I mean, there is a kind of hopelessness, I'm sorry to say, hearing no mores that were written in 2017, the very morning after an incident like this. And any words about how you might encourage people to hear the music on a day like today?
Wow, that's a tough question. For me, listening back to it today, it's just to know that I can make decisions for myself and for my loved ones that can help us not be in the situation where we are part of the problem.
Are there any planned performances of No More in Kansas City?
None that I know of so far. Missouri Western did a performance of it last year.
Well, our time is up, but Anthony Maglione, composer of the song No More, with us from William Jewell College, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you, Gina. It's a pleasure.
That's a wrap. You can find both of the conversations from this morning's show at kcur.org/Central Standard later today. That's kcur.org/Central Standard, and that's where you can get any of the conversations that you might have missed any time. Earlier this week, we spoke with a researcher at MU who studied how the pupil size relates to mental health states, and we have a lot of interesting content there. Look it up, kcur.org/Central Standard. Tomorrow, you know the guy who runs around Kansas City in a Superman costume? His name is Michael Wheeler, and he is retiring, hanging up the cape. Hear his story and call in to talk about what seeing him around town has inspired for you. That's tomorrow on KCUR Central Standard. If you miss us between now and then, you can talk to us on Twitter. We are at KCURCST. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with Coy Duggar, Chris Young, Suzanne Hogan, and intern Salisa Kalakal. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Don't go away.